بشرع تتسقط عنه ويلا ارحل يا بشار
يلا ارحل يا بشار
ويلا ارحل يا بشار
يلا ارحل يا بشار
ويا بشار ويا كذاب وتضرب انت وهالخطاب الحرية صابت على الباب ويلا ارحل يا بشار
يلا ارحل يا بشار
ويلا ارحل يا بشار ويا بشار ويا كذاب وتضرب انت وهالخطاب الحرية.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. He's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books. He teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo and the Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. He has an article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, The Politics of Fear, and the forthcoming issue, How and What Obama Won. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be here.
I can't tell you how good it is to hear your voice after we've been struggling to get through to you live.
I'm sorry you've had trouble.
No, I know. It turned out we had to call you via Israel. The Palestinian numbers weren't working. But I'm glad we're talking to you. You are in the West Bank. Of course, I don't know whether you were in Gaza with the triumphant return a couple of days ago of Khaled Mashal, which was an extraordinary event. Let's start with that. What's the sense there of course, the idea that he reiterated Hamas's rejection of Israel's existence, but he did also, he's apparently due for reconciliation talks with his rival Fatah, the Palestinian Authority. So let's start with Gaza. Did you witness any of this or did you watch it on TV?
No, I wasn't in Gaza. I'm in the West Bank right now in Ramallah. This West Bank, as your listeners I'm sure know, is governed by the Palestinian Authority, by President Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Salim Fayyad. And the reconciliation that has been talked about, of course, is between Mashal and Hamas, which rules Gaza. And Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. People have heard about reconciliation talks before, of course. In fact, there's an agreement signed months and months ago that supposedly represented a reconciliation between the two bodies. Nothing has really come of that. So I think there's a general skepticism about what actually will emerge. I mean, people will be willing to believe it when they see it. It's a strange atmosphere here now in the West Bank. There is, as you mentioned, a sense of triumph in Gaza. The notion's been put about that Hamas won the recent war or semi-war with Israel by getting them to agree to certain concessions, opening up slightly the roads into Gaza. The sea borders have been loosened somewhat. More broadly, you had a kind of redefinition of the regional forces, which I think is much more important. That is that the Egyptians essentially came to Hamas's rescue and reaffirmed that the Arab Spring had a decisive effect on regional diplomacy. That is, you no longer have a Mubarak sitting in Cairo willing to back the Israelis and punish Hamas. You suddenly have a regime, a Muslim Brotherhood regime under Mr. Morsi, that really sees Hamas as their brother organization. You know, they came from the same roots. So from the beginning of this conflict, you had the Egyptian prime minister visiting as the bombs were falling on Gaza. He came and visited Gaza. You had the Tunisian foreign minister. You had the Turkish foreign minister. You had a delegation from the Arab League. I mean, this is completely new in regional politics. Usually there's lip service given to the Palestinian cause, but very little action taken. And I think the Israelis were rather shocked by this, by the pushback. And it led them not to, though I saw the enormous buildup of tanks and other equipment right around Gaza and southern Israel, they did not, as so many Israelis wanted, by the way, they did not intervene on the ground. And I think this was perceived certainly by Hamas and many Palestinians as a kind of victory. But I wouldn't say that there is a sense of euphoria here or a sense of optimism. The situation remains quite grim. You know, the last substantial agreement was Oslo in 93, which promised a Palestinian state no later than 1999. And you've recently had the announcement from the Israelis that there would be zoning and the beginning of development of the so-called Area E1, which is a chunk of the West Bank surrounding Jerusalem, which in effect would cut the West Bank in two and really doom any notion, any real practical notion of a two-state solution. So, you know, they're very mixed feelings. I'd like to, you know, talk about triumph, but I think that isn't really the tone here. There's a long way to go for any substantial progress to be made.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Denner, longtime writer, journalist, and professor, a staff writer for The New Yorker, regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, where he has an article, The Politics of Fear, and a forthcoming article, How and What Obama Won. He's in the West Bank. Mark, it would seem, though, that the fact that the focus is on Hamas, that they're feeling triumphant every time they have a war with Israel and get trounced, they nevertheless end up basically celebrating victory, and it all makes the Palestinian Authority look irrelevant and look somewhat castrated. I don't know it's medically possible to have multiple castrations, but how much more can Abu Mazen stand?
Well, the multiple castration line is sadly appropriate, whether it's medically possible or not. The fact is that the Israelis have now, of course, in addition to saying that one of the consequences, you know, the move to the UN, because Abbas, of course, went to the UN and was granted non-observer status at the UN, that the Israelis are punishing that on the one hand by talking about the development of E1, on the other hand by the building of, I think, 3,000 new housing units on the West Bank, and on the third hand, talk about medically impossible, on the third hand, cutting off tax payments. This is money that the Palestinians actually pay, that Israel collects. They're going to cut off these payments to the Palestinian Authority. And essentially, if they do that, the Palestinian Authority will collapse and won't have any more money. The sad thing, of course, when you say castration, I mean, the PA essentially is viewed by many on the West Bank simply as a kind of handmaiden of the Israelis. It handles security. It polices the West Bank. Within Area A, which is Palestinian-populated cities, it serves as a security force, and it does it in collaboration with the Israelis. So the Israelis, in sort of trying to cut off the funds, are really doing themselves, as so often in this conflict, they're wounding themselves. I mean, they're essentially dealing themselves a blow because their security is ensured by the Palestinian Authority, which is one of the reasons why the PA is so unpopular here. It's by many people, it's simply viewed as the kind of handmaiden of the Israelis. And now the Israelis will cut off their money. The PA may conceivably collapse, although the Arab League today voted, as your listeners may have seen, voted to replace that money. We'll see if they actually do it. But the Israelis, often do this. They kind of take measures against actions by the PA that in effect hurt themselves, the Israelis, and they're threatening to do that now. But as you say, Gaza and Hamas has now scored a considerable victory at the expense of the popularity of the Palestinian Authority, which is very low to begin with.
Clearly, the role of Egypt has always been important since Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood and now in power in Egypt, although obviously there's a tremendous amount of pushback from the very people who brought about the revolution in Egypt that toppled the Mubarak regime. They're very unhappy with the power grab of Morsi's. He today said he would he backpedaled on some of his decrees, but nevertheless wants to go ahead with the referendum that the opposition are going to boycott making it more likely that a Muslim Brotherhood constitution will come into effect. So Egypt is going to go through a long and tortured period. Morsi came out of those talks with that settled the latest mini war between Israel and Gaza. He settled the deal with Hillary Clinton, and Morsi came out looking good, and then promptly issued the decree, grabbing power. Right. But a part of the decree, what I find interesting is that apparently the U.S. Contingency in the Sinai is going to be increased. And the idea that you've got this lawless badlands in the Sinai where a lot of the rockets coming in from Sudan, with the Israelis recently bombed from Iran via Sudan into smuggled into the Sinai, that the U.S. are going to be policing this lawless land, going after jihadis. That's a two-edged sword, isn't it? The jihadis want to kill Americans. So if you put more Americans in the Sinai, isn't that going to mean more American deaths?
Well, it's possible. It's possible. It presumably will also give the Egyptians, more of an incentive to keep those people out. So I don't know whether you'll see more American deaths. I mean, the fact is that we've now entered a period, as you pointed out pretty well, of significant instability in Egypt. These things, obviously the Gaza situation, the Egyptian situation, the Sinai situation that you've just described, are all linked very tightly. Morsi moved forward on his decrees, no doubt in part because he scored a considerable political victory in negotiating the Gaza peace, looked like a great peacemaker and key figure in the region. He also, of course, that morning, I think, or the morning before, signed a $5 billion agreement with the IMF, another triumph. So he was feeling politically very strong, and he clearly overstepped in issuing the decree he did. On the other hand, the opposition is in a peculiar situation where they cannot hope. I mean, they're in a game where the key to the game is votes, and they are not in a situation where they can win when it comes to votes. And it's a very difficult situation to be in, particularly when a substantial number of them are Democrats. So they're trying to take him out of power in the street after he's been elected, and after he has passed a constitution, which by all indications is a shoo-in to win, that is to win, to be passed and ratified by referendum. I think we're in for a period of increasing political instability there. There's no real solution to that problem. When you have a democratic game in which none of the opposition parties really has a chance to win in the democratic game, you end up having politics of the street. Whether there will be deaths of Americans or not, I don't know. I do know that the Sinai is becoming an increasing flashpoint, and of course, troop movements in the Sinai and rules about what you can do in the Sinai and security in the Sinai are a key part of the Camp David Accords of 1979 between Israel and Egypt. And that is essentially the red line in the relationship between Israel and Egypt. Will the Egyptians, now under a Muslim Brotherhood government, continue to observe all the provisions of that peace treaty? That's a red line for the Israelis, and that's a red line for the Americans. So we're in very delicate territory. I mean, up to now, Morsi certainly has. But one wonders at what point the Israelis find themselves increasingly threatened by what's going on in the Sinai, and what will they do about it?
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, who is a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New Yorker Review of Books, where he has two articles in the current issue, The Politics of Fear, and the forthcoming issue, How and What Obama Won. And he's in the West Bank, and we're speaking to him live. Of course, the previous guest we had on, Mark, we talked about not just Egypt, but also Syria, which is really coming to a head. You've just mentioned some red lines for Israel. The U.S. has also issued red lines over the use of chemical weapons. The opposition, the Free Syrian Army, is closing in on the airport to try and shut down the flow of arms coming in from Iran. But they're also going after the chemical weapons as well. Our previous guest suggested that Assad is crazy and cornered and ruthless, and it wouldn't be a complete surprise if chemical weapons were used. And it, furthermore, it would not be a total surprise if Assad struck out at Israel with Scuds with chemical weapons on them in the way that Saddam Hussein struck out at Israel during the Gulf War. To change the subject, if you will. So, what's the sense in the region there that this could really turn into the ultimate nightmare, which is the use of weapons of mass destruction?
Well, I didn't hear Yusuf's fully elaborated argument. I just heard the last few words of it. I think the scenario of Assad attacking Israel with chemical weapons seems far-fetched to me. I mean, we are entering an area here in the final days of at least the first phase of this conflict, which is what it seems, where anything could happen. I mean, it's clear that the regime, I agree Assad has proved himself ruthless. There's no question about that. I don't know if he's crazy. The regime is clearly fighting for its life. It's done it by using artillery systematically and the Air Force as well on cities and towns. We're told lately that there is activity at these bases in which chemical weapons are either being moved or possibly being prepared. That was the leak to the New York Times. President Obama has said that this is one of our red lines, although I believe the first, the Times detailed this the other day, that the first red line he announced, which was before the election, I think it was in August, was that, the red line was if these things were moved. I think the administration has now backed off that and said the red line is if they were used. I'm not sure what exactly the administration would do about that, frankly. I mean, its options are not, it's not as if it has a lot of options. I don't think they want to intervene in any way on the ground in this fight. It's an enormous mess, and the American people would not support it. I mean, there is not any appetite for another ground war in the Middle East. So what would they do? You cannot bomb chemical weapons depots effectively because you essentially... you can't be sure of destroying them. There's no way to be sure that you're not going to activate them and cause secondary deaths by bombing them. So it's a very difficult problem. By the same token, chemical weapons are very horrible. I've always resisted a little bit that phrase weapons of mass destruction because I think it joins together several different weapons that are very different. Nuclear weapons, for one, which we're not talking about. Chemical weapons are terrible, no question about it, but whether their use in Syria would mean a kind of apocalypse, which is what many people are talking about, I'm not so sure. Saddam Hussein used them in Kurdistan. He killed, 3,000, 4,000 people. Again, it was very terrible, but the end of days did not come. I think if Assad used these weapons on civilians, there would be the kind of worldwide reaction that perhaps the Syrian leadership still would not, would fear enough that they would avoid taking that step. It may be that they're mixing the weapons or moving them as some kind of signal to the West that they should intervene to stop this conflict. That is, I'm not sure that we should take this, we should not take the leak of this movement on these bases. I'm not sure we shouldn't take it with a bit of a grain of salt. That is, it may not speak completely for itself. It may be about, in some way, signaling and trying to force some kind of action from the Russians, for example, or from the Iranians. I don't know. I honestly don't know. But I think Yusuf is certainly right that it is possible for this to spiral out of control in a very horrible way. the fact is that more than any other conflict arising out of the so-called Arab Spring, the Syrian civil war involves area forces in a very inextricable and dangerous way. You have the Iranians as the main sponsor of the Assad regime, with Iraq, our supposed ally, helping. You have the Saudis and other Gulf countries supporting the Sunni insurgents in Syria. So you have, in effect, within Syria, a kind of hot war expressing the so-called Arab Cold War between the Saudis and the Iranians. And whenever you have a war like that, in which the local players are in part representatives of larger forces, there's a danger it can spin out of control in a very bloody way.
Well, yeah. Mark, I thank you so much for joining us from Palestine and for giving us your up-to-date report on what's happening in that tortured and tumultuous region.
My pleasure. It's good to be with you, Ian, and I'll look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. He's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books. He teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. He has two articles in The New York Review of Books, The Politics of Fear in the current issue, and How and What Obama Won in the forthcoming issue. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the UN climate conference that just ended empty-handed.
Did it all get real? I guess it's real enough. They got refrigerators full of blood. Another century spent pointing guns at anything that moves. Sometimes I worry that I've lost the plot. My twitching muscles, teeth, my flipping thoughts. I never really dreamed.